So who are we missing here? Where's Larry? Oh, there he is.
Bob.
And does anyone know where Steve is? Well, Steve will be in a minute, I'm sure, and you already know his history because I've already introduced him. And I think he's coming right now. Just like a rock star. So this is our second afternoon panel to focus on the topics related to fisheries and their management as covered by Steve and Larry's talks. And in addition to our speakers, we have three other panelists. The first is Jake Kreitzer. And Jake is a senior scientist at the Environmental Defense Fund, and he's the chair of the New England Fishery Management Council Scientific and Statistical Committee. His work focuses on reforming the management of important regional fisheries. We also have Bob Senek, who's an old friend. I first met at Bowdoin College back in 1986. And Bob is a professor at the University of Maine School of Marine Sciences. His research has established him as a leading authority on the factors influencing the structure and function of marine ecosystems, particularly in the Gulf of Maine. Bob's published over 140 papers and is presently focusing on how complex biological and social systems interact and what drives their resilience. And then finally, we have John Grabowski, who needs no introduction.
John, all right, then, let's go.
John is associate professor at Northeastern University in the Department of Marine and Environmental Sciences. He has a very broad expertise that's led to major contributions in marine ecology, fisheries and conservation biology, and ecological economics. So thank you, folks. We enjoy listening to your discussion.
Great. Well, thanks very much. And I will manage the clock a little bit better and give you guys time for more questions. I mistakenly thought we had 70 minutes. We only had 60 minutes last time. But we have 70 this time. Well, almost. At any rate, there'll be more time for questions than before. And what I'd like to do is start actually opening up this conversation by taking this fascinating conversation about fisheries and bringing it into town, make the local issues. And I wonder if I could just sort of throw that question out to our localish panelists and talk about when you heard about these global things, how are you thinking about applying them to issues here? And maybe Jake, you want to start off on that?
Sure.
Just get close.
Okay. Well, that's a big question. I think Steve or Larry, one or maybe both of you, touched on the cod fishery and the troubles, to say the least, we've been having with it. I think we've been trying to do some of the things that that Steve in particular focused on with moving toward a more rights-based approach, which I think has helped the fishery quite a bit. And it's strange to say that given the severe quota cuts we're facing, given the economic pain that is bringing about to the fishermen. But at the same time, I think under the old, more inefficient system, things would be much worse the fishing year before us. The other thing that's really complicating the status and management of the cod fishery is that the effects of climate change that Steve and particularly Larry touched upon, I think, are really, really hitting home. And it's been something that, you know, as a marine ecologist, we've been talking about, thinking about, preparing for quite some time. But for a while, at least for me, it felt abstract and something in the future, and now I feel like we're really seeing it. We're seeing
in what form?
Well, we saw last year in particular. Now, 2012 was the hottest year we've had on record, and right now the cod population in the Gulf of Maine is really piled up in the western Gulf of Maine, which is a somewhat counterintuitive situation because it's most of the fish are sitting right in front of all the major fishing ports. And you might expect the exact opposite situation, where the areas nearest to the fishing ports would be depleted and it would be more distant waters that have more fish. We're seeing the opposite, which I think has to do a lot with the oceanography of the Gulf of Maine that pushes a lot of the larvae into that area. But nevertheless, it's made the fishery somewhat, you know, fairly viable despite the overall poor status of cod, because fishermen can get to those nearshore cod and fish them in a fairly cost-effective way. Well, what happened last year was the exceedingly hot temperatures pushed a lot of those fish north, pushed them out into deeper waters of the Gulf of Maine, areas that have been devoid of cod for a long time. Now, that could actually be a good thing in the long run if that pattern holds, because the stock will do better if the fish are better distributed, and if they are, if all our eggs aren't in one basket spatially. But it was a big problem for the fishery because it made fish hard to find. So for a population that was already depleted, suddenly the density was lower. Fish were in areas that the fishermen haven't been working for quite some time and were harder to find. So that was a very real and tangible effect of climate change that may be a temporary phenomenon or may persist, and we'll see what this year and the years ahead show us.
Yeah, and Bob, I think you've also worked with cod some. I wonder if you would talk about that a little bit, and maybe bring in some lobsters too, because they were alluded to, but I think that's an interesting story as well here.
Right. Well, the North Atlantic, by and large, was a fish-dominated system, not like the North Pacific, which is a marine mammal-dominated system. And what we know is from our archaeological evidence that we've had at least thousands of years of cod dominance in the Gulf of Maine. 85% of bone mass from some of the Indian middens are just codfish bones. And yet, there's been this serial extirpation starting on the coast, working its way to George's Bank, and then in the 1990s, sort of the last really big set of cod were knocked down to such a low level that not only did we lose cod, but we lost the dominant predator in this ecosystem. One of the things that's happened is that almost all the marine resource value that we have today are formerly a prey of the cod, and chief among them are lobsters. And lobsters were, the reason why we like them is because for the same reason why a lot of predators like them. They're, they have good fat, and they're actually pretty slow, and they're easy to catch, and so when those predators were gone, these exploded. And so now we have vast areas that have over 2 lobsters per meter square, and that's the highest density in the world. It's a hyperpopulation density that has, it's a lucrative monoculture with very, very high dependence on that single species. What we're looking at as we move forward is a world that the Gulf of Maine and the rest of the world is getting warmer. Within the next century, the Gulf of Maine will no longer have temperatures that cod can tolerate, so they won't even be players any longer, even if they could come back. The lobsters have been moving. They have a sweet spot where their larval settlement and growth is optimum, and that's been moving north. So the Bay of Fundy has many more lobsters now than it had 20 years ago. But we're also seeing blue crabs in the Gulf of Maine, and we're seeing black sea bass, which were centered in the Chesapeake area. Red hake have moved in. And so here's the problem that I see, and it relates to what Larry was talking about in terms of governance. We've got a highly dynamic system. Species are changing at a very rapid rate, but our capacity to manage moves at a glacial pace. And so we have to have ways of becoming much more reactive to this rapidly changing, complex world.
So, and you alluded to the fact that these things do take time. Even if you had a more rapid system, it's still these are tough issues to solve, as we've seen here. Let me actually ask a question or two about your presentation. One of which is the gold standard you're using is this maximum sustainable yield. That's sort of that's what everyone is, that would be sort of the optimal, at least economically speaking. But that doesn't take into account the fish that you may want to leave in this ocean for other fish to eat, right? And I wonder, a couple of questions. Is that really the right target that we should even be managing around? Because it has become the default, and talking about changing management, if you change the standard you're going to manage by, that adds another layer of complication, obviously.
Yeah, no, I think this is it's a key point in the sense that you have to be able to state what your objectives are up front. And so if your objectives are maximum amount of food, that may be an appropriate standard.
If you're eating the anchovies that the salmon might want to eat.
Well, no. The nature, ideally, calculating what the biomass for maximum sustainable yield, you'd have to take into account how those species interact with other species. I mean, because fisheries interact in that sense, and that affects the yield that you can get out of it. But there may be other situations. I mean, the anchoveta off of Peru is a perfect example where It's the world's largest fishery. It's over 10% of all the fish we take out of the ocean. And it used to be, as you can imagine, the base of a gigantic food chain that all kinds of other species depended upon. It's actually a very well-managed fishery today from the standpoint of the yield. But by drawing the stocks down to where we're getting this maximum level of production for us to take out as much as we can, it's had really big consequences to penguins and marine mammals and a variety of other things along those lines. So if you have a broader array of goals, which is yield but also maintaining these key charismatic species at levels of a certain level, you would set a target, which is a higher level of biomass in the field.
And does anyone do that? Or is it just basically how much can the fishermen get and still have population to go back to next year?
Well, I mean, you know, this is one of those things that's interesting because of the fact that, I mean, economists have been arguing for a long time that we should actually be shooting for a target that is above maximum sustainable yield because actually profits go up. And you get, so that's a perfect case where you get simultaneous benefits, both from the standpoint of economics by moving to a maximum economic yield, as well as leaving more fish in the water for other things in the ecosystem to be consuming. So we actually just completed an analysis for the government of Peru, which shows that their fishery would make substantially more money if they left significantly more anchoveta in the water. And they're considering actually doing this. So it's kind of, this is, I think we got to look for more and more situations where achieving multiple objectives are aligned by a common approach. And this is one where I think going more to maximizing dollars actually enhances conservation benefits relative to maximizing total production.
Hmm. So John, do you what lessons did you draw out of this from your own frame of reference of the local fisheries and so on?
I was definitely very interested in, you know, taking some of the local.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
I was very interested in taking some of the local fisheries issues and trying to see how we can apply that to some of the fisheries issues we have here. And you know, I think some of the things we've been finding in working with the cod fishery is just how important trust is, and you know how the current system, you know, it points to the fact that in this realignment to stakeholders has helped identify that some of the key components of the fisheries management system, who these people are that are real leaders that could potentially step in and really help out, I think, in redirecting the fishery. You know, for example, the sector managers. It's not surprising that they are well trusted, but it's a really good indication that the management process could work, you know, in the sense that if they didn't trust their own sector managers, we'd be in a complete state of disarray. I mean, we're close to that, but I think that's one silver lining that's, you know, coming out of some of the work we're doing.
So could you build that on top of the federal fisheries management that basically dictates these fisheries, or are you suggesting this as an alternative?
Not as an alternative. I'm just thinking about if you take some of Ostrom's thinking around looking for social institutions and how that can help fisheries management, you know, getting greater involvement from those people in the management process. And these are people that are already very tapped from from NOAA and the National Marine Fisheries Service. But the question I think that's important is, you know, are they being used as effectively as they could be, you know, to convey messages in both directions so that we can potentially move more towards a co-management system?
Yeah, and I guess, Larry, one question is, do they trust the facts that the fisheries scientists offer them? I mean, because if you don't agree on the basic facts, then can you, how far can you move on these?
Yeah, I think that it's pretty clear that trust isn't just among fishermen, but for co-management to work, there has to be trust between government and fishermen that goes both ways. The past actions and reactions haven't really built a lot of trust and social capital between the people who are making the government decisions and the regulations and the enforcement and the fishing community. And you can do the retrospect of the autopsy, if you will, on that relationship and say what went wrong, but we have to start where we are now. And so I think that one of the things that's really important is involving fishermen helping understand the problem and helping come up with pathways to solutions that might work for them. Rather than assuming you know the mind of a fisherman, actually try to understand where they're coming from. That takes some time, but you know, I think John pointed out effectively that even in the cod fishery, the remnant of the cod fishery, there are sectors that are working, like Cape Cod Hook Fishermen's Association, that really is a small community of fishermen that share a fishing gear, that share a goal, that appear to have good trusting relationships within their sector and within their sector leadership. So, you know, they're happy to have their sector leaders go speak for them to the government management people because they trust that their leaders are representing them. When you have no leadership, when you have no trust, it's hard to do any of this except via top-down regulatory heavy-handed enforcement, you know, where the individuals who break the rules are suppressed. I mean, that's how it works.
I think both John and Bob have a comment about that. Did you want?
Well, I think one of the vehicles that helped start to build trust in this region and in others is collaborative science between, you know, fishers and scientists. And unfortunately, one of the major vehicles for that, the Northeast Consortium, no longer funds science at a very significant level. I mean, but for a solid 10 or 15 years there, it was, you know, putting scientists on boats and coming up with ideas together and funding science that they felt could influence the management process. And that did a tremendous job, I think, to build better buy-in. Stakeholders actually involvement in the process is key. And then the ideas that, you know, the people that are on the water are seeing things that, you know, scientists aren't. So there was a lot of good crosstalk there.
Yeah, and the crosstalk is valuable because we are talking about very different cultures, and you have to sort of learn this language. I still use local fishermen primarily as my research vessels in different areas because they absolutely know these areas. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to pick up on a thread that Larry started on, and that is anytime you're out with the fishermen, I really don't care where it is, you find out that they are terrific problem solvers because if you're out for 5 days, you're going to be spending two or three of those days solving problems on the boat. And there's problems going on all the time. And these guys know how to deal with things locally. And so I typically will have these get-togethers, and it's usually over beer. And these guys are bigger than me, and I lose. But, you know, I ask them, how's fishing? And they typically will say it's not so great. And not the lobsterman, of course, but then I say, well, what would you do to, you know, what sorts of things could work that aren't being done? And then you start hearing these floodgates of ideas. And what one group would say in one region on the coast of Maine would be really different than what would be you'd hear someplace else. And they both work. And so the question is whether we can take this kind of mosaic of traditions and cultures and integrate those effectively with information that they can trust so that we can help them, and, you know, fish sustainably. After all, sustainability is job security for these guys.
So it's a question of building those relationships more, it's a tricky business. Let me turn to something Sylvia Earl said yesterday, which she implied in her talk that basically she would never eat seafood. And I wonder if any of you share that point of view, and if so, how you justify continuing to eat seafood. Steve, that may be an easy question for you, since you're sort of arguing, oh, there are plenty of fish in the sea, more or less.
No, I'm not arguing that there are plenty, but I think you have to look at, you can't look at this as a question in isolation of impacts. I mean, this is the challenge that anything we eat has environmental impacts. And that's true if you're a vegan to, you know, only eating beef. I think you have to look at this in the context of what's the range of alternatives and what are the various both social, environmental, and, you know, economic costs associated with different food. And the more we've looked at the range of environmental costs and a variety of different metrics, I just showed one, seafood has some of the lowest environmental footprint of anything you can eat. It's actually lower in a lot of ways than eating as a vegetarian on some land-based sources for different kinds of metrics. So it's, you know, you still want to use best practice. I think that's really the key here is thinking about how we minimize those impacts and learn from the, you know, the innovation that people have made in different places. But excluding eating fish, from my standpoint, because it has impacts on the ocean, has bigger impacts on the planet than eating the fish would in a responsible way.
And we have dangerously high densities of lobster, so please eat Maine lobster.
I agree with Steve completely. I've been on the Monterey Bay Aquarium Seafood Watch Advisory Board for over a decade, and what that little card does is provide you useful advice on what they deem to be more or less sustainable. But a lot of people just say, I don't know what kind of seafood to choose, so I won't eat any. And you throw it out the door, and you say, so let's talk about sustainable beef, and sustainable chicken, and sustainable pork. And so I think that, you know, Steve and many, many others have looked at this, at the statistics, and seafood is actually a very, very good choice for protein. And I think one of the things that's happened, of course, is as we've overfished wild stocks, we're substituting with aquaculture. So half the seafood imported into the U.S. is aquaculture, mostly in developing countries, mostly without very good environmental protections. And so half the seafood that you get on your plate in the U.S. is coming from countries where, because we've overfished global fish stocks, we're substituting with aquaculture, and that's good if it's done in a sustainable, best practices kind of way. It's bad if it's not. And one of the things that people often argue about for aquaculture is we tend to want to aquaculture the same things that were wild capture fisheries. So you want to aquaculture tunas and salmon. And that would be like basing terrestrial agriculture on we like to eat lions and tigers and bears, right? And we would just raise ungulates in order to feed the lions and tigers and bears because we want to eat the lions and tigers and bears. And so right now, by going for high-end predators in aquaculture, we're actually having to subsidize by overfishing forage fish to feed them. So one of the things that I like to fantasize about is imagine a healthy, productive ocean ecosystem that could produce as many fish as perhaps New England did 1,000 years ago. If you could hit the reset button, we probably wouldn't have to worry about aquaculture. We could do a much better job knowing what we know now, managing those fisheries. And so the problem is, how do we get from the hole we've dug ourselves into to restored, rehabilitated ecosystems that, in fact, can, you know, by doing what they do, fish produce protein that would be available to people. We just need them to give them the opportunity to do what they do.
Yeah, Jake, do you want to take on the aquaculture question, or do you want to go back to the
question? Well, I was going to answer your question about eating seafood.
Okay.
I definitely eat seafood, and there's several reasons for that. I agree with just about everything Steve and Larry said, and I'll add a few more reasons. One, it tastes really good, and
especially Maine lobster. Yeah, go on.
You know, two, I mean, at least when I'm in the States, pretty much everything I eat is from the States and mostly from New England. And I think the U.S. has set a pretty high bar. It's a bar that has developed through time. And so even on many of our fisheries that are fish stocks that are in rough shape, for the most part, have pretty good management systems now, and we're giving them a chance to recover. And I think that's actually an important criterion when deciding what, you know, kind of seafood you deem to be sustainable. That fishermen who have taken the steps to do things better, it's going to take time for those changes to come about, but should be rewarded by having people buy their products. So, you know, I feel pretty good for the most part of eating U.S. caught seafood. I also, you know, another reason I eat seafood is just because it's for me, it strengthens my connection to the ocean, which I experience in many ways, but eating seafood is one way. But another reason is actually because I think, you know, we focus a lot on overfishing, justifiably, as a major impact on the ocean, but it's not the only one. And I think a stable, secure fishing fleet can be your first line eyes and ears and stewards against other ocean impacts. And so having fishermen out there, you know, I don't get out in the water anywhere near as much as I'd like to. And having those guys out there day in and day out to be watching for changes and particularly negative changes, I think is a really valuable service. I think in too many cases, fishermen aren't able to really fulfill that service because they're too focused on the battles within the fishery management arena. But as we continue to improve and strengthen fishery management systems, they can actually broaden their horizons. And I've seen that in some fisheries, that the management issues are less, they pay more attention to other impacts, and like I said, really are those first line stewards and eyes and ears. So there's a lot of reasons I think to eat
seafood. So John, let me give you a twist on this question, which is, do you eat farmed fish?
If it's responsibly farmed, yes. I mean, I think in some
species... And you can tell?
You know, some species I think we want to be farming, things like oysters. You know, I think... And there's certainly other species. I think finfish, it depends on where it's farmed. You know, there's definitely farming efforts ongoing here, you know, that you'll see on Seafood Watch to say that, you know, U.S. farmed fish, it's not a problem. If it's farmed and it's coming from the developing world, it's still a real problem. Because it's probably resulting in things like mangrove destruction. I think that you know, the citizen-based science that you're talking about there is really important when we're talking about, you know, offshore fisheries, near-shore fisheries. These are areas that are fairly difficult to get to. So it's even more important, I think, you know, than the value that comes from those kind of activities in you know, freshwater and terrestrial environments.
So. Let me ask about what it takes to get back below that line and back over to the right in your graph. I mean, do you need to... I visited Fort Bragg, California a few years ago, and it was sort of a ghost town from fishing. I mean, they had five or six vessels left, and it used to be essentially a fishing port. And they said, well, we're fishing sustainably now, which means that basically most of our fleet went away. Is it... I mean, what help me understand... is this, you just need to temporarily reduce fishing, or do you need to permanently reduce fishing, and the value comes from having the fish that are left be more valuable?
Yeah, very good question. You know, the unfortunate problem with fisheries is that if we overfish, there's only one way to get those stocks recovered, and that is you have to cut the number of fish that are being caught. So there is an unavoidable period of pain associated with recovery. There's no way to get around that, okay? And you can stretch it out by making the pain be smaller for a short, you know, each year, by, or you can make it really extreme and minimize it by shutting down the fishery entirely, and that's the shortest way to do that. But there's no way to avoid pain, which means that the first lesson is, don't get into a state of overfishing. There's, because there's a large cost of fixing that problem. And this is, I think, one of the challenges we face with a lot of these reforms, is that they almost always get implemented when we've really put the fishery in a bad state. So all of the pain of recovery now gets associated with the new management system, when in reality, it's associated with the past management system that got us into this overfished state. And but that, you know, that doesn't translate. So you know, that you we have to go through these, you know, these economic costs. And so I think one of the ways to that we're thinking about in this is, how do you actually think about tapping into some of those future benefits to pay for the short-term recovery? Most of the way that happens now is you have buyouts that are government buyouts of the fleet, reduce the number of people that are fishing and things along those lines. But you know, if you can forecast, and that's the other advantage of knowing what the status of the fishery is, then you can forecast how much better off would it be if you fix it. And if you know what the potential economic upside is, you potentially can pull some of those future profits forward to pay for the short-term benefits. In essence, by you know, getting investors to pay for the short-term recovery in exchange for tapping some of the long-term benefits of those materialize. And I think this is a really underutilized potential way of solving some of this pain problem, which is to use the forecast we can, get people that have that don't discount the future as much as most people in the fishing industry do, to take the risk of tapping some of the future profits to pay for some of those recovery phase.
But do you come back up back to your previous fishing levels, or you never do?
No, because if you're really overfishing, you could have been catching a level of, you know, a number of fish that is impossible to ever maintain on a sustainable basis. So, right. I mean,
so is it possible to get more protein out of the sea then? If you move to an entirely sustainable level of fishing, aren't you talking about then less protein out of the sea?
No. I mean, so this is why that one analysis we did was we looked at, you know, what is the total upside that you can get from fixing all the world's fisheries, right? And it's, you know, at the upper end, it's only about a 30 to 40% increase over what total catch is today, right? Now, that doesn't mean that in some places it can be well over 100%. In some fisheries, it can be well over 100%. But in other cases, yeah, you don't get as much of a gain as you think because if we're overfishing today, we're actually catching more fish than you can do over the long term. I mean, but you also would not be able to maintain that level of catch for the long term, right?
Yeah.
So relative to where the fishery could be, if you extend out those lines for any of the fisheries, if you go out another 10 years, we're going to be at a point where the catch levels are not only dramatically lower, but the time it takes to recover goes up, you know, really lengthens in a really dramatic way.
Yeah.
So it's a good thing to start fixing the problem before it gets too bad, because
yeah.
then that period of pain is short.
But there's also a point that we haven't gotten into, and it's relevant to what you're talking about, Steve, and that is bycatch and discards. And that is, you know, we've been talking about single species like cod, but in going for a quota, often species that aren't wanted or for which there's a very limited quota also get harvested, and they can't be landed, and so they go overboard dead. They don't make it to the market. They actually reduce the amount of seafood that's available, and they degrade the ecosystem. And some of the fishermen that I've been working with have been spending most of their spare time figuring out ways of developing harvesting methods that minimize bycatch and discards. And so they're really trying to, and these are small-scale fishermen who actually, you know, they can't go for stocks and are on George's Bank. They have to depend on what's really at their doorstep. And that's where I'm seeing very innovative problem solving going on. And I'd say that it is possible that we could start seeing more species making it by fishing smarter.
And what motivates them to do that? I mean, is it just the nuisance of having to toss things overboard, or is it compassion for the fish that
some of what they're tossing overboard are undersized fish that they would love to harvest in a couple of years.
Huh.
Add something on that. The bycatch is an interesting issue because it takes many different forms. And so a lot of what I think Bob is referring to are sort of what we call regulatory discards, where basically by regulation fishermen have to dump fish, either because they're too small, because the regulation has set a maximum number they can land per trip, a species that's completely prohibited, etc. But there are also plenty of discards that are completely the choice of the fishermen, or I guess the choice of the market, just completely unmarketable species that will take up room in the hold for very little economic gain. I think one of the interesting and really encouraging things that's happening now, at least in New England, in response to the declines we're seeing in some of the marquee species like cod and flounder, is efforts to promote and market and sell these underutilized and unknown and undervalued species. So, and that includes species like dogfish, pollock, hake. In some cases, I know chefs that are even experimenting with things like sea robins. And so there's an effort underway to make more a wider mix of species more palatable as a way in the near term of offsetting the economic losses due to quota cuts in cod and flounder. But I think there can be a real benefit in the long term of harvesting a more diverse mix rather than waiting all of our fishing pressure on a few species that, for really not very good reasons, are the ones we value most. So that's a very new trend, but there's been so-called trash fish dinners that some of the top chefs in Boston have run, cooking fantastic dishes
yeah.
with species people have never heard of. So I think that's a real encouraging direction.
That reminds me of the lionfish story. Does anyone here know the lionfish story and want to tell it?
Sure.
Well, yeah, Bob, yeah.
You know, lionfish is a Pacific tropical reef fish that has exploded throughout the Caribbean, and it's an introduced species. It actually eats larval fish, so there's a lot of concern about what its impact's going to be, but they've been encouraging the spearing and eating of lionfish, and I just had it last month. It's delicious. And in fact, in some places, there's good evidence of lionfish populations being significantly lower on areas that they're being selectively taken out. So that's kind of a, you know, it's unfortunate that we have that introduced species, but then there's a species that we should all eat when we can.
Yeah. But you need to be careful there, obviously, because...
Well, because they're poisonous?
Well, no, that for sure. But, I mean, we also don't want to become dependent on that fishery to the point that it then becomes an incentive to introduce it once we...
No, we want to overfish that.
There's no place in the Caribbean you can introduce that species to now.
Yeah.
It's sort of totally saturated. So, Larry, let me ask you, we have, as I recall the statistics, something like 80% of the seafood that is in our seafood counters is actually imported, and we can do all we want to have good fishing practices domestically. What can we do, or what should we do to influence what's happening on a broader scale, globally?
Well, you know, I think that's really challenging, but the key is like any other food that we consume, we should know where our food comes from. And we're a long way from the pictures that Steve showed of the food chain or the value chain where the fishermen are offshore and they come and sell their catch on the beach. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not atypical for seafood, wild-caught seafood, to be transferred to 6 or 7 or 8 different buyers. So figuring out where things come from, the traceability is really complicated. And because fish are taken in one fishery and sold and resold and so on, it's hard to trace them. But in order for our consumers to know where did this fish come from and is it raised in aquaculture in a more sustainable way or a less sustainable way or whatever, we need to be able to track where things come from. And most of the people who are working in the sustainable seafood movement are really focused on those traceability issues. Mm-hmm. One way to narrow that gap for consumers that are really worried about it is like knowing who your local farmer is, knowing who your local fisherman is, is a really good thing. And in Monterey Bay, there's actually something called a community sustainable fishery, like community sustainable agriculture, that has 400, 500 subscribers. It's the second largest in the country. Works with 7 or 8 fishermen in the Monterey Bay area and has over 400 families that buy shares of that fishery. And the fishermen who catch the fish actually bring them to the people that come to pick up the fish, and they talk about where did you catch them and how do I cook this? I don't know how to cook it and things like that. And it's building a community where the linkages are much closer. I think that if you're eating seafood at some of the large chain restaurants, and I'm resisting the urge to say names, you don't know where the hell those shrimp came from. So good luck to you. And I think that, you know, what people are doing is looking at classes of organisms that are thought to be raised or harvested in a more sustainable way and steering away from others like shrimp that there are many, many doubts about. So the closer you are to your purveyor of seafood, the better.
Right. That's, of course, a luxury for and not available very many places. But I read a few years ago there was one in Boston. Anybody know if that's still a going concern? Yes. The CSA in Boston?
Yeah. It's working in Maine, too.
Is that right?
And you pay a lot more money for it, but it's actually worth it.
Yeah. So, but in terms of influencing fisheries practices globally, Jake, do you have a... Give us 3 great suggestions.
Wow.
Or one.
One.
Well, I think one. I mean, Larry made the important, and I think somewhat sobering point that, you know, 80% of the seafood that Americans eat is imported, and I think so. On the more positive side, they suggest we have a lot of power in that marketplace. So if we change our purchasing practices, and say we only want to buy imported seafood. I mean, I think we should be eating primarily local seafood first and foremost, but to the extent we are going to eat imported seafood, if we set a high bar for how those fisheries are managed, we can shape their management. So that's one thing we can do as consumers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that many of the seafood, sustainable seafood groups started about 4 or 5 years ago is what they called the large buyer program. Most of them began with the white tablecloth restaurants and the chefs and the high-end consumers who were willing to pay more. But they realized that really wasn't changing fisheries on the water. So they went after the large buyers that are the food distributors all over the U.S. and the EU, or the big stores like Walmart. And they actually pressed those companies to make pledges about just selling sustainable fisheries. And Walmart made a commitment, which they're going to have a hard time honoring, I think, to only sell MSC certified seafood. Because when they made that commitment, Walmart alone could buy all of the MSC certified seafood in the world, leaving none for the rest of the people who wanted to buy it. So I think that there are moves to influence the market from large and small buyers and attempts to get at certification, both for wild-caught fish and for aquacultured fish. All of those have challenges with the market chain and traceability and actually knowing what you have. You've all seen the headlines about, I went and I bought 74 red snapper fillets and less than half of them were red snapper when you do the genetics. And so you could argue there's either a lot of fraud or misinformed people or sorting fish by convenience because the red snapper case is empty. But I think as consumers, I mean, you know, one of the things we can try to do is make sure that fishermen and purveyors are kept honest. And one of my favorite personal stories is I was in Santa Barbara for an NC's working group, and we went to a very nice restaurant, and it said wild troll caught salmon, and we're going, gee, I wonder what species it is. Maybe it's Chinook, maybe it's this or that. And so we asked the waitress, what kind of salmon is it? And she goes, oh, I don't know, I'll go ask the chef. And she came out and said, wild troll caught Atlantic salmon. And we're going like, no. And so the chef is out talking to us, and we're explaining there are no wild troll-caught Atlantic salmon. And if your fishmonger sold you these as wild troll-caught salmon and he's giving you aquaculture Atlantic salmon, you just got ripped off by a factor of 10. It was a really educational opportunity. And I think you have to take advantage of those when you can to help people with making better decisions. And people are incensed by being ripped off. If you're paying five times as much for a red snapper and you're getting some other grouper that's less desirable, you should know that.
If you can taste the difference, I think they're counting on you're not being able to.
Yeah, well, most people don't have that trained palate. That's true.
Yeah, Steve.
I think there's is. I just want to make a cautionary note that I think there's only so far that consumer demand can fix this problem, and that goes back to this issue of how much of a pull is there at the level of the fishermen. And if in fact you only get onto these green cards or get certified after a fishery is fixed, then you know the fishermen only get this benefit after they go through this period of pain. And if that's a 5 or 10 year process, you know, the amount of pull that it has for them to kind of go through a process to get certified gets really reduced. And so I think this is one where we really have to recognize that you've got to focus on the supply problem and taking successes that have worked and try to get those implemented in a much broader array of places and then couple that with the continued demand. But I don't think that we can come close to fixing this problem at a global level by only focusing on the demand side.
Is there something governments can do or our government can do on this, do you think? I mean, I know that we get involved in these international agreements over, you know, tuna and so on, and we have at least a voice in that. But as you kept pointing the finger at Europe doesn't necessarily listen to the voice. I'm not sure how effectively the government is making that case. But it's, I know that certainly their public position is that, you know, you've got to scale back on your Atlantic bluefin tuna fisheries and so on.
Yeah, I think there's that. There's also, I mean, and participate in fisheries where we actually participate as a country, I think there are places like that. But the other is, I mean, there are potential for development bank funds to provide the kind of financing that I was talking about before, where, you know, here's a perfect example where if you put development bank funding into a developing country to go through the reform, take some of the cost out of going through the recovery, that's something where there's a fairly predictable potential for them to then have greater livelihoods, you know, down the line, that you can pay back those development loans. And so I think there are ways that these international funding organizations could actually play a really big role in incentivizing these kinds of transitions by taking out some of the risk and the short-term cost to make these things be much more rapid in their process. Mm.
John, did you want to add something?
Yeah, I was going to say, I would completely agree that that's not going to, you know, the consumer-driven solutions are not going to fix the problem. But I do think it's an important message, though, to, you know, those that want to do something,
sure,
that we do live in the information age. So it is very easy to sleuth out for yourself, you know, more information on a fishery. There's a lot of valuable resources,
yeah,
at your fingertips. And most of us that are making these kind of decisions, you know, have a computer at our fingertips at almost all times, for better or worse.
Yeah. And I'd like to just add that I was doing a project on forage fish, and we went down to Peru, and what the presentation we heard from the Peruvian fisheries folks was how they intend to meet the milestones set before them by the Marine Stewardship Council. Now, in this committee was Daniel Pauly, who's a rabid opposition to the MSC, but what I thought was most interesting was it was very obvious that they were taking concrete steps to fish more sustainably because that structure was in place.
Yeah.
And I just thought, at least that is an incremental step in the right direction.
Yeah.
Larry.
Yeah, and just to add to Steve's point, you know, if the World Bank or somebody else is going to make this investment to help the transition, then one of the things they might want to ask is, as wise investors, you know, kind of goes back to my talk, where is this, in what communities and what circumstances is this investment likely to be successful? And
mm-hmm.
if you have a completely dysfunctional fishing community with poor leadership and distrust, that wouldn't be a good place to put your money down, mm-hmm. compared to a place where you think there's better potential. And of course, it's always a bit of a crapshoot when you make investments. Is this the right place or the wrong place? But if we do this deliberately and take a scientific approach, we can learn what kinds of strategies are most likely to be successful and which ones are not. And you learn from the cases where you fail, and you learn from the cases where you succeed. So I think that when you start getting into the, especially in developing countries, when you say, so, you know, is Peru a good place to invest, or is Jamaica a good place to invest, or is Indonesia? It's not by country, it's almost by village.
Mm.
Where there are functional communities in a particular village with good leadership and so on that are really like primed to make some transition to sustainability, and others in the same country that just are not ready for prime time. And what you would have to do in those communities is work with them to identify leaders, build capacity, and so on. But why would they even want to do that? They'll want to do that if there are some communities in their region where things undergo a transition and it's much better, and they say, we want to be like this village over here. And you say, well, these are the steps that you might need to take, consider taking to move in that direction. So we're not over prescriptive here. And of course, given that there are tens of thousands of small scale fisheries, there's ample opportunity for experiment to see what works and what doesn't work, and to learn from that experience.
We will take questions from the audience. There's a microphone. Please come up and ask a question. And introduce yourself and ask a question.
Okay. I'm Noelle Rellis, and I'm a faculty a professor at a college in upstate New York. With a degree in marine science and my little Mbari sustainable fisheries card in hand, I still find it difficult to figure out where my fish are coming from. So I don't know how you expect Joe Citizen to do that. And I'm not sure if the answer is something like, you know, now, even if I don't want to know it, McDonald's has to tell me how many calories are in what I'm ordering there. And just last night, I went to a very small upscale restaurant in downtown Boston, and the waitress had no idea where the cod came from, didn't know if the salmon was farm-raised or wild-caught. And I was just wondering if there's any sort of legislation to put the responsibility on restaurants, waitresses, chefs, those types of, so that they have to know. So.
Anybody have any experience?
As far as I know, that's not required. Sometimes when you get the answer, I don't know, it's because they don't want to tell you what they know. So I think that, you know, as a consumer, you know, not like obviously if you're in Boston for an evening, you're not going to drive the economy here. But if you're a consumer that regularly in a particular town, you can press the staff to know that information. And if the waiter doesn't know, you say, good, well, let me talk to your manager. Let me talk to your chef, right? And without being terribly confrontational, you can just say, look, you know, I want to eat in your restaurant. I think it's a great place. But I also need to know where's my food coming from. And it might be the vegetables you're worried about, where do they come from, or the fish. And the caution about the seafood, the bewilderment about the seafood card is that, you know, people get confused and they say, oh, I don't know what to do. I just won't eat seafood. And as Steve made very clear, that's not a good choice because, you know, in the other protein realm, you have three or four species that you worry about, right? I mean, so a chicken is a chicken, but really a chicken isn't a chicken in terms of how it's raised. A free-range chicken is different than a factory chicken in terms of how it tastes and how sustainable it's operated. So even if you're eating chicken, you'd like to know where did that come from and what's its carbon footprint and things like that. And so I think that we ask too little about our food. If you don't ask, people certainly aren't going to volunteer that information.
Can I add something to that?
Sure, yeah.
Another way to go about this is also how you choose the restaurant you eat at. And there are, you know, I alluded to this earlier, there are some really progressive, innovative, leading chefs right here in Boston on this. And so, you know, there's some restaurants that I go to that, honestly, I know this stuff because it's my job, but if I didn't, I wouldn't need to. I can trust that these guys are putting sustainable, generally locally caught seafood on the table. So it can actually perhaps be easier to research restaurants than it could be to walk in and have to figure out what's on the menu, whether it meets a certain standard or not. There's a group called the Chefs Collaborative, which is trying to move in the direction of getting its membership to adopt more sustainable purchasing standards. And so looking at groups like that, looking at individual restaurants' kind of philosophies can actually make the job a lot easier. You know, a chef has a lot of power. Right? He's sort of making decisions for large numbers of people. And if you can find the chefs that are making the right decisions, the rest of us don't have to worry about it.
Somehow I think that, DeWitt Brown, Nahant, somehow I think that oysters are the most local seafood that's almost all cultured. Are there any wild seafood, wild oysters that are made, are consumed, and what are the possibilities of local oysters?
Anybody?
There are wild oysters.
There are wild oysters.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The Gulf of Mexico still has probably the healthiest wild oyster fishery.
They're coming back to the Damariscotta River.
They're coming back, yeah. I mean, I'm talking to some of the locals here that fished mussels and said, you know, areas we traditionally saw mussels in the last 10 years, we've seen more and more oysters. And, you know, being someone who's worked on oysters in a lot of other parts of the world, I was very interested when I first came here to knock around and look. And, you know, the more places we go, the more oysters we find. And I know even, you know, Boston Harbor, unfortunately, there's some really good data to show that, you know, oyster fisheries, basically were fished out starting in New England and moving south, and that you can look at the date of the peak of the fishery. You know, we don't have good estimates on that, although there is a local group, the Mass Oyster Partnership, that's focused on bringing back oysters to the region. And we don't have as good a handle on when were the peaks in the fisheries because they were fished out so long ago, and it's been, a real challenge to restore those reefs here.
Yeah, I guess part of the challenge, I mean, obviously you're better off eating lower on the food chain from getting protein out of the sea, right? Because you get more bang for your buck, if you will, and oysters are an example of that. And I gather scallops in this area are also one of the big sustainable cash crops from this region as well, right?
One of the problems with wild oysters, though, in terms of sustainability is that it's also a really important habitat. that provides an array of ecosystem services, you know, such as filtering the water and reducing, you know, anthropogenic nitrogen issues that tend to happen pretty commonly in estuaries, stabilizing shorelines. And so that's one of these lower food web ones where it actually makes sense to leave the wild ones alone or fish them sustainably, but and then culture them as well.
Yeah. So are there oyster farms up here, or the prospect of bringing them back? Or?
Sure. Yeah. There's, it's a kind of a boutique aquaculture industry, you know, $2 an oyster, but they're doing okay. The scallops, you know, single most valuable species in New England, and I think the East Coast, but it's you have to drag for scallops, and so there's a habitat concern that John was talking about when you're talking about that kind of habitat. You know, you've got very slow-growing deep-water corals that get in the way of these kind of drags, and it would take centuries for them to come back. And so there is a lot of concern about what we can harvest sustainably that doesn't have habitat, you know, collateral damage. Hmm.
Hi, Brian Rossborough from Concord. I'm here representing two institutions, Earthwatch and NEON. And my question really relates to the challenge of changing behavior for the successor generation. We're talking about a 25 to 50 year time span. I'd like to start by thanking, however, Dean Gibson and Jeff and the panel for the extraordinary uplifting performance, and I see with no plastic in front of you. Even
see, local action can make a difference.
years ago, I was asked by somebody in Washington to come and host a room like this, and the challenge for me was introduce sustainable development to 5 and 4 generation loggers and fishermen from New England. And I was refreshed by the hostility in the room, because they said it was a fancy word for limiting their lifestyles, their freedoms, and their choices for their families. And my strategy for survival was not to be a talker, but to be a listener. And what I heard was far more than their individual economic concerns. Their driving motivation was to hand their lifestyle off to their children. They wanted their children to stand in the same forest, to go to the same sea, and that was terrifying for them, that they couldn't feel that life responsibility. So my question is, since we have one generation, are there imaginary programs that you know of that take the children of fishermen and loggers, even the children of the owners of the large fleets and the food companies, and put them together with scientists and the harvesting of these natural resources so that they can in fact stand in their parents' shoes, but in your capacity as stewards for the resource?
Hmm. Interesting question. Anybody aware of something like that?
Yeah, there actually is a lot of interest in developing local education nodes. There's one on Hurricane Island in Penobscot Bay. The Gulf of Maine Research Institute, where John just left, left a big hole too. I mean, you know, just conceptual. and the whole idea is exactly that. It's really networking. You know, the ivory tower days are over. It's a matter of sharing information, building trust for the next generation, and. You know, in Maine, there's a limited entry to the lobster fishery, but if you're of a lobstering family, you go through basically apprentice and be a stern man, and you can become part of that fishery. And the idea is in the transfer of that information. And I think we are seeing this evolution. It's kind of a co-evolution where these fishermen understand the basics of oceanography and marine biology. We had a really unusual year last year, oceanographically. Unusually warm, the lobsters shed really early. The lobstering community up and down the coast responded to that faster than the physical oceanographers realized we were having an anomaly. And it's so interesting that they are in touch with this environment. They're imparting that to the next generation, and what we're trying to do is give them a little bit more of this longer, larger view of sustainability through education programs done at a number of sources.
And Larry, does this happen in the small fisheries internationally? I mean, what, how much of that value do people grasp, and how much of that is their motivation?
Well, you know, I think the point you make is really an important one. Those of you who understand economics know this concept, discount rate, which is how much you discount the future relative to the present, like a dollar in hand now is worth 60 cents next year. And so we operate with a discount rate in almost everything we do in economic transactions. The legacy you're talking about is a discount rate approaching zero, which we don't do. In other words, the value of a resource 5 years or 10 years or 100 years from now is worth less to us than the value of the resource now. And the people who are thinking about the legacy for their children and grandchildren would use a low discount rate. But that's not typically how our economy works at this point. So I think that in small communities that have, on Pacific Islands, for example, or isolated fishing villages that have evolved these cultural evolution, basically, of fishing rules that tend toward sustainability and tend toward resilience, aren't looking to maximize anything. They're looking to meet their needs this year and leave enough fish in the water so they can meet their needs next year and 10 years from now and 100 years from now. And so I think that the contrast is people on small islands don't have a lot of alternatives. They need to meet their protein from the fish that are there. If you have to get in a sailing canoe and go 1,000 miles away to some other island, you are unlikely to do that. So you can't just use the resources and move. You have to make the resources work in that location in the long term. And that those cultural practices have evolved in hundreds or thousands of places that are towards sustainability, but it's not the way we design sort of Western-style economies for using these resources. So I think those values are passed on in the communities where sustainability has been a critical issue for them historically. It's not an academic concept. It's not a government imposition. It's their life.
Next question.
Yes, I'm Bill Dietrich. I'm a professor of biochemistry and marine biology at Northeastern's Marine Science Center. I've heard a number of very interesting suggestions as to how we can act locally and small scale and sort of moderate scale in influencing the future of the fisheries and so on. But one thing I don't think I've heard is programs that we do with our farming community. So I haven't heard about, you know, paying fishermen not to fish. I haven't heard about setting up a commodities market so that fishermen can sell into a market that provides them with a guaranteed income. And it's the future that guarantees how that income is going to change. But for any given year, you have some opportunity to sell into a market at a known rate, and you can make your plans that way. Are these ideas that might be put into play in dealing with fisheries?
Jake, do you want to take that? Because I know that some of the cat shares thing, processes do involve those kinds of approaches, right?
Yeah, and I think the short answer is yes. And it can be done in many different ways and has been done in many different ways. There's, I think, a good case study that I wasn't involved in, but my organization was and have some familiarity, was out in Morro Bay in California, where back in, I think back in the early 90s, if I'm getting the timeline right, the Pacific groundfish fishery was in really rough shape. And so EDF and the Nature Conservancy basically started working with the local fishing community to buy some of the fishing permits and necessarily reduce effort. I mean, there was too much effort for the fish stocks at hand, so it let some of the fishermen get out and get compensated for getting out of the fishery.
Including buying the boats, not just the permits,
that's
right?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. And then through time, though, what has happened is you know, the environmental groups and the local fishing industry have worked with the management agency to reform that fishery toward a catch share model that went online a few years ago, is showing some really positive results to the point that now the Nature Conservancy owns those permits and is beginning to negotiate selling them back to the fishing community because the quota attached to them can be fished now. There's fish to be caught. The NGOs feel good about the management system, the trajectory that the stocks are on. And along the way, there was an important part of this was a switch from trawl gear to less destructive hook and line type gears. So I think that's in the spirit of what you're talking about. You know, again, it was an overcapitalized fishery. There needed to be a reduction in effort. It just wasn't ever going to be viable, I think, for the resource to sustain the level of effort it had been sustaining. The fishery experienced a significant balloon payment of catching more than could be sustainably harvested. But once that effort correction occurred and the resource could recover, and the management system was improved, the access is being transferred back to the fishery, and now they're reaping the benefits of both a more effective management system and more effective fishing gears. So, and there's a lot of examples like that out there.
Yeah. We have time for maybe one more question. Go ahead.
I'm Owen Liu. I currently work with Jake at GDF. I have a question about, Larry, one of the interesting things I think from your talk was, you know, if you want it to last, it can't be fast, right? You have to go into these communities, especially in these small scale developing world places, and really understand the community context. But at the same time, as we've heard all of today and in Steve, your talk, you know, these fisheries, especially small-scale fisheries, are in really, really bad shape. And there are some solutions, or we at least have the beginnings of a toolbox, right, to look at solutions. And Bob, I know a lot of your work looks at kind of adaptation and resilience. So I guess my question is there some way to, you know, go into these places, put in some sort of framework for a solution, but at the same time provide for this longer-term learning and adaptation. So is there a way to kind of marry both of those themes that have come through with the talks this afternoon?
I think, Owen, that's the hope. You know, most of the practitioners who have actually gone into communities and worked at sustainable strategies that last find that it takes a decade. And the question is, if you talk to 100 people who have done that and you looked at best practices and approaches, you actually came up with an approach that would allow you to decide for communities with particular kinds of characteristics, the particular kinds of interventions were likely to work, you might be able to then generalize and shorten the process. But, you know, unless you're coming in as a dictatorship with guns and things like that, it's hard to make things change fast and sustain them. You have to have, you know, one of the problems with marine protected areas has been enforcement. Pretty easy to get paper parks established, but actually enforcing them so they do what they were gazetted to do is very difficult. So what people have later discovered as well. So we need to engage the local communities and get them on board with the benefits of this approach, and that takes time. So, you know, I've actually challenged some colleagues to say, so how fast could this be done? And they're skeptical that you can really do it in a 2 or 3 year campaign to change things. You really have to work in each of those communities. But as I suggested, that work doesn't need to be as costly, because you might be able to work with local leaderships in a community, local leaders in a community, and local NGOs and so on to discover a lot of that information. I'm thinking if it gets to a science, we can speed things up a bit, but we can't expect, you know, an out of the box solution to work everywhere.
Yeah, I just wanted to add one thing, and that is that I think the bottleneck is usually not at the fishing community. I think it's the local community is most adaptable. You know, adaptation is a matter of how you learn from the system, and how well you're connected to the system is something that regulates how quickly you learn from it. The problem that I've seen is that the capacity to react at a local scale is much faster than the capacity at governance when you're talking about polycentric sort of systems, where it has to be endorsed by the federal government in our country. And that's something that I think we have to start addressing so that we can build agility into our fisheries management, which right now does not exist, but it's going to have to moving forward.
All right. On that note, thank you all for sticking with us for this afternoon. Let's give them all a hand here.
Thank you. Thank you.
Don't go anywhere yet.
Oh. So just to wrap things up formally, I really like Bob's quick to get out of here. He's got a pint waiting for him somewhere.
Red Sox game.
Yeah, Red Sox game. I'd just like to thank you all for coming to this conference. This is the first of what Murray and I hope will be more conferences down the line. I'd also like to thank our speakers as well as our panelists for really contributing some wonderful insight and perspectives on the issues that we discussed, and of course Richard for navigating, you know, rather complicated territory in some cases. I think Bob, as he often does, really captured it best, I mean, in terms of what this initiative is about and what we're trying to do, when he said that the days of ivory towers are dead. And, you know, that really is what this initiative is trying to do. It's not like we're the first people to say that scientists and policymakers and engineers and lawyers need to talk together more effectively. But what we're trying to do is bring the people here that are actually interested in walking the walk rather than talking the talk. And I think a second part of that, which Bob also alluded to as well as Larry, is this issue of trust. And so, you know, when you're managing a fishery, you're trying to build trust among stakeholders and managers and scientists, etc. And what we need to do as a university and academic community is build trust among disciplines so that scientists, architects, engineers, policymakers have faith and trust in the common endeavor of taking this interdisciplinary approach to sustainability. So I'll get off my soapbox. Thank you all very much. That's what we're trying to do here. We appreciate your support. More things to come. Cheers.
Thank you. Nice meeting you.
Thank you.